about five, relatives of three British people killed in the Italian earthquake have expressed their gratitude for the love they've had from the Italian people. A couple in their 50s and a teenage boy from another family died after the villa they were staying in collapsed. Our Europe correspondent Mark Stone is outside the home near Amatrice.
Will Henniker-Gottlie and his wife Maria Henniker-Gottlie, both of them tragically died in the earthquake. Their two children remarkably survived, and survived almost unscathed, as we understand it.
An optometrist who missed the signs of a fatal brain condition in a child has been given a 2-year suspended prison sentence. 8-year-old Vincent Barker from Ipswich died around 5 months later in 2012. Surrey police say they're still taking reports of a young boy being taken into a van in Redhill yesterday extremely seriously. Officers say they're now looking for a different model of black VW transporter van. An NHS body insists no decisions have been made after a leaked document revealed some hospitals and A&E departments in England may close. A campaign group's found 44 areas have been asked to draw up efficiency measures because of growing budget problems. Shadow Health Secretary Diane Abbott says costs need to be brought down.
We want to set up a unit to manage those contracts better, to make sure they are delivering what they're supposed to deliver. The other issue, of course, is agency staff. £3.6 billion on agency staff. You're paying more to the agency staff themselves, and you're paying the cost of the agency on top.
WhatsApp has come under fire after announcing it'll share data, including phone numbers, with its parent company, Facebook. Now the Information Commissioner's Office says it's looking into the privacy changes to examine whether it's legal. That's the latest. I'm Annie Green.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council, councillor for Southville, Charlie Bolton. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, from Tynings Primary School in Staple Hill right the way up to the elite at Clifton College Public School, schools are looking the other way when presented with evidence of pervert teachers. And as they prepare for the new academic year, they're flouting the government's so-called admission rules. Plus, Turkey and the US formally moving troops into Syria. Does that mean NATO are finally invading? Are they allowed to do that without either going to their legislature or the UN? And why do so many people seem attracted to ISIS? Is there something in the Quran that tells them this might be a good idea? And are the Western military secretly using the Quran to make sure they have an excuse to intervene in Syria? And the old chestnut of whether Hitler survived World War II, a new angle on it this week as we look at the fraud trial and imprisonment surrounding the film version of the book Grey Wolf. Why would a hedge fund manager put up the money for a dodgy docudrama film about Hitler's so-called life after the war? Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. And on to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, tonight, that's down to 12 degrees Celsius and a clear night. This bank holiday weekend, 22 degrees roughly, warm all weekend. Some cloud tomorrow, that's Saturday, and generally sunny, but cloudy and possibly rainy too on Sunday afternoon. Next week, that's on to Bank Holiday Monday, clearing up for a warm and sunny Bank Holiday Monday. The rest of the week, warm and sunny too, occasionally clouding over next weekend. It's the 3rd and 4th of September. Saturday is weather is actually very good again next weekend. Saturday better than Sunday though. And the week after next, mostly dry and sunny and your light shower of rain. That was your two-weekend weather forecast from weatheroutlook.com. Thank God we got a lovely, looks like, Bank Holiday Monday coming along. So, helping us review this week's news, it's the leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council and councillor for Southfield, Charlie Bolton. Hi, Charlie. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. Thank you.
Now, I think, am I right in saying you're one of the longest serving Green councillors in the city?
Oh, I am. I am the longest.
The
serving.
Longest serving. How long has it been now?
Well, I've done 6 years, my seventh year. It's one term of four, and then I had 4 years off and back again.
So, when were you first elected, and were you actually the first?
I was the first Green Party councillor ever elected. 2006. I won by 7 votes. So, there's 11 of us now. It's much nicer.
There's a lot of, but it's actually gone down quite a lot, hasn't it? Before we talk about that, just tell us about, you know, why you think Southville was the first ward to return a Green councillor in the city. Because it's traditionally Labour. I mean, it was Dawn Primorolo, very, very strong, safe Labour seat.
Well, most of South Bristol used to be very strong, safe Labour seats. So Southville, Windmill Hill, Bedminster, other places. I think it's partly it's luck with me. It's partly stubbornness or persistence going back those years, and it's partly the key wasn't for me wasn't winning. It was coming second, and therefore proving you're credible.
What about this time though? Because it's not been a very good result for you in these local elections. But, in fact, even losing your party leader.
Yeah,
in the local elections back in May.
Yeah, we had 14. Councillors, including one person who defected after last meeting, went down to 11. We have debates about whether it's a good result or not, because obviously there's been the whole Corbyn thing, which has probably taken away, or rather given the Labour Party active support, and perhaps taken some away from us, or taken away some enthusiasm from us, but Labour has obviously got its own difficulties.
Well, hang on a minute. Yeah, but it's interesting because the local MPs would probably disagree with you. They say that Jeremy Corbyn is not an asset to the party at all. He's a loser. From a Green Party point of view, I mean, is it right to say that quite a few Green voters have switched back to Labour?
I couldn't give you numbers, but I know I'm aware of some people who I know who've tried or have joined the Labour Party for this round of leadership election in Labour, people who I would assume are naturally Green. I mean, to me, it's the political activists, the Corbyn supporters are going to be political activists, and they're the ones who are going to do the work on the ground, so that's the benefit it gives to the party they support. I might even agree that Jeremy Corbyn's a liability as a national leader, not to the extent that our local MPs do, but I understand their difficulty.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? It's a funny kind of quandary, this, because Fangab Debonair, Karen Smith, Kerry McCarthy, our local Labour MPs who don't want to come on this programme at the moment,
right.
I think they're waiting until there's been some sort of a result. We'll see if they do then. It'd be nice if they would, but they aren't even replying to my request for them to come on at the moment. But they are saying effectively that Corbyn is bad for the Labour Party. I mean, aren't you, as a Green, a little bit concerned that if Corbyn does get re-elected again, this could be, it's almost like some of your core support is going to go to Labour, because people will see the Greens, where with one MP, Caroline Lucas, as not actually able to change things at a national level, whereas the Labour Party can with Corbyn, with a potential majority at the next general election.
I think personally I would agree with you that there is a potential for it not to be so good for us for the reasons that you give. Having said that, I can't see the Labour internal row stopping after the election, whoever wins. It's just like it's gone too far for that. I mean, I remember the SDP splitting off in the early 80s, and it seems worse than that to me for Labour. So I'm not sure it's good for either of us.
Let's bring Martin in here. Is it some sort of self-immolation by the left? It's sort of, this kind of thing does seem to happen quite a lot, doesn't it? Seems a bit Python-esque, reminded of the People's Republic of Judea fighting away with all these various other factions.
Yes.
And it does look as if it's gone too far, as Charlie was saying there, that even when or if Jeremy Corbyn is re-elected as leader, that there's going to be more fun and games to come from the Labour right.
Well, there is, because it's the electoral system forces us into this loveless marriage between, there's not much in common between Tony Blair and somebody like Jeremy Corbyn. Not really. They're in the same party because it's necessary for them to be in the same party to win under a first-past-the-post electoral system, which is long past its sell-by date. In other European countries, there are more than two parties, and people can, you know, pick the party of their choice, and then coalitions are formed on the back of that. The problem with the first-past-the-post system is it forces us into this, it to be corralled in, and I don't think it is going to end easily, but I would draw attention to what happened in New Zealand in the early 1980s, where the left wing of the Labour Party forced PR against a sitting Labour government, which was pursuing Blairite policies avant la lettre. And of course what happened there is they forced PR, because they've got no House of Lords there, no City of London, no great big this is the way we do it, you know, they can just change the rules, unicameral parliament, they got a more than half the electorate to sign up for a referendum. No, they forced it, and then they won it.
What do you put all this silence from the Blairite MPs down to, or the, you know, the pro Owen Smith MPs? What's that all about? I mean, it's a brilliant article, I thought, in the medium.com, which is this, originally it was a kind of crowdfunded investigative journalism site with people like Nafees Ahmed, Paul Mason, who used to be on Channel 4 News and Newsnight, now seems to have kind of given up with trying to tell the truth through the mainstream press, even through Channel 4 News, and is now freelancing. His article's called "The Sound of Blairite Silence: Owen Smith Has Become the Willing Dupe of the Labour Right." So he's implying that Smith, if and when he loses, is going to be completely jettisoned. What do you make of this concept?
Well, I think it's an interesting article if you're interested in the minutiae of this.
Quarrel. I'm interested to look ahead 6-8 weeks.
And see, yeah, well, I think he's right. The Blairites aren't very happy about Owen Smith either. Owen Smith is a centrist candidate, but of course there isn't much room for that. And I think that he's not going to win, but the Blairites didn't want somebody like him anyway. They wanted Angela Eagle, who voted for war in Iraq, voted for war in Syria, but didn't oppose the welfare reforms, etc., etc. And so there's going, you know, they've agreed to support Smith only as a means of trying to stop Corbyn.
So what's going to happen if they fail? Is it going to be
the nuclear
option, and is there going to be legal action by the parliamentary Labour Party to try and wrestle the name of the Labour Party away from Jeremy Corbyn and the membership?
That is what is being planned, according to Mason, and he's a pretty well-informed national journalist.
What he's referring to in this article is Bajot.
Walter Badgett.
The Badgett column of The Economist, who these are written anonymously, but he's named the guy who writes it, which is lovely to see. Well done, Paul Mason, because I really despise this idea at The Economist that every article is written by The Economist, and there's lots of hiding of who the journalists are. A couple of weeks ago, the Economist was talking about what they thought would happen, and Mason is saying, actually what he's saying here is that I'll just quote from this Economist article. True Labour's role would then not be to compete amicably with Mr Corbyn's Labour, but to marginalise or destroy it by appropriating the Labour mantle through sheer weight, dynamism and persuasiveness. I see few reasons to believe such a party would lack the talent, prominence and funding potential and organisational ability to do so. And then he goes on to cite, Paul Mason that is, goes on to cite various websites he had been set up, it seems, in order to get ready for the Corbyn winning this leadership election and the next phase of the plan of this coup plot.
Well, I think that's possibly right. We will have to see if that comes true. I think the fact is that they're not going to be able to get the name Labour Party. The trade unions, by and large, have supported Corbyn, apart from the GMB and the Bakers. The funding from the unions and the name Labour Party comes from all of the things, you know, the NEC, all the legal arguments that we've been having. So if they set up their own party in Parliament, it'll have to be something else. They can call it True Labour if they like, but it won't be the Labour Party.
Sadiq Khan, London Mayor, has come out against Corbyn, hasn't he? I mean, it does seem as if there's going to be this kind of trickle, drip, drip every week, some other major figure coming out in favour of Owen Smith. One wonders which way, if anyway, our very own Marvin Smith, he may come out as a Marvin Smith.
Marvin I keep calling Owen Jones.
sorry about that. But maybe Marvin will come out as a pro Smith. What do you think, Martin?
Well, as I understand it at present, I'm reliably informed by those who say they know that he's going to remain neutral and that he persuaded Sadiq Khan to take the same line. I can't understand why Sadiq Khan's taking this line, because if he looks at the figures, he will see that Smith has got no chance of winning whatsoever. So he's then going to have to live for 4 years with Jeremy Corbyn as the Labour leader.
Well, maybe he'll be part of this coup phase.
He might be able to form relations with this new party that the right will form in Parliament. But the fact is, under first past the post, then we're all dead in those circumstances. But we're all dead anyway, because the Tories are going to gerrymander the constituencies.
Could this not be partly due to the fact that Sadiq Khan was an MP before he became Mayor of London?
Yeah.
Therefore, he's in the mindset of the other Labour
Absolutely.
MPs who've gone the way they have.
Anyway, less navel-gazing with left and Labour-y politics.
I just say one thing?
Sure.
Had either of you heard of Owen Smith before the leadership election? Because I hadn't.
No.
No, he just fitted the bill, didn't he? Yeah. Someone who was media friendly, because Angela Eagle wasn't. She appeared on Daily Politics with Angela.
She was
Neil.
Too right wing. It wasn't just that.
I mean, she made a mess of the TV appearance. And these days, if you can't do the TV stuff and you don't hang together as your arguments on television, then that's it. You can't be prime minister. I don't know how many of our venerable old previous prime ministers would have got on in the TV age, but anyhow, that seems to be one of the main things nowadays. You've got to be good on telly. But anyway, Charlie, here in the City Council, we've had some pretty shock news this week. Actually, I certainly had no inkling of it. Maybe you did, about 1,000 redundancies in the City Council. Now, we've already had cuts and cuts and cuts through the years of George Ferguson when he was mayor. We're now being told another 1,000 redundancies. Marvin is asking the public to say who they want and don't want, which seems a bit bizarre. I would have thought that was the council's job to decide, you know, where the most important services are and keep them. We've already had all these previous tranches of cuts. This to me seems like this is the real deal. This is when the cuts really start to bite and affect frontline services.
I have to agree with you. I mean, you're right. When I was a councillor in 2010, before the Tories got elected and started austerity, I remember then that senior managers saying, whoever wins, there will be cuts of up to, I don't know, 20% or something, and they were preparing for it back then. And I think they've managed or tried to manage their way through the, don't know, 60, 70, 80 million we've had so far, and they've done it with some success, because most of the services, the frontline services, still exist. I could use the low-hanging fruit expression in a moment, but it's that's all gone. And now, yes, I think you're right. I think God only knows what it's going to mean. I mean, and it's not only up to 1,000 redundancies, but that it might have to be done over a very short period of time, which is probably going to cause chaos within the council.
Is it fair to see, really, George as doing a bit of sort of trimming around the garden? Now Marvin's here, it looks like he's going to have to be the hatchet man, or does he have to be? Does he have to do this?
Well, he's going to have a balanced budget. I mean, we've been trying to find out. We already knew there's going to be £60-70 million of cuts, and actually I was talking to Tony Dyer, who was our mayoral candidate today, and he said he thought he had something in I think he's on the Bristol Post, saying there'd be 80 or more. He was saying that just after the election. We'd got a briefing from senior officers into the run-up to the mayoral election, which shared with all candidates, saying something like there's something like £13 million of unidentified cuts, another 18 where we think we've identified it-ish. The issue with the £29 million, this is additional to the cuts we knew about before, the council knew about before. And I suppose the Labour narrative is it's trying to blame it onto George, and I don't know if I entirely buy. I mean, the austerity agenda is clearly the Tory government imposing it. So if the Tories weren't in power, we wouldn't be doing it at all. It is now getting worse and worse, and this is just, the Labour way of trying to deal with it. Now, having changed their chief executive, having got elected, having learnt how it all works, Marvin coming to power, having a new cabinet, and there being perhaps a bit of a vacuum for the last few months within council. So there was, at some stage, we're bound to reach a stage where no more low-hanging fruit. Now this looks like it's going to affect services badly.
Just looking around, I mean, particularly where I live in St Paul's, it seems to be less and less going on. Things like whole kind of no-go zones where areas of greenery are kind of taking over the pavements, loads mm-hmm. of rubbish being left for long periods of time without being cleared up. Sometimes locals having to actually go out and clear rubbish up themselves because the council aren't coming. I mean, what are we paying our council tax for exactly?
The largest proportion is split between the schools and between adult social care by a long way. It's predominantly that. There's some on the waste collection in neighbourhoods.
But I mean, it seems that there's a deliberate attempt to run down local government.
Yes, I'd agree with you that. I think you do wonder. Yeah, as a councillor, I wonder whether you reach a stage where. What's the point in getting elected if all you're going to do is implement somebody else's cuts? And it's always going to be this balance between what you can do and what you're forced to do. And it's just getting harder and harder and harder. And I do feel a bit sorry for Marvin, because I'm sure he doesn't want to get rid of 1,000 people. I'm sure he's not that sort of person. But he's been forced into it by the financial
situation.
And is
he kicking off against central government enough about this, do you think? Because it's not... You know, it's not our fault as council taxpayers.
Well, he needs to, I mean, I think, and I spoke to him, I said, I think he's going to do this. He needs to get together with whoever he can to go to central government and say, look, this is too far. I mean, Theresa May, whatever you think of her, is a new Prime Minister, and maybe she has a different approach. One suspects not. But it's certainly worth going and asking the question of, can you change the local government settlement, at least for Bristol? But it's also serious opposition to it. Well, the Labour Party controls all the core cities. Surely they should be getting together and putting up a united front and saying, enough is enough, yeah. You've got to stop.
Well, he's certainly not doing that. Looking at the coverage of these 1,000 job cuts, he's saying things like, well, the best we can do is have some kind of voluntary redundancy scheme. So, I mean, he's just going along with it. It doesn't seem making any kind of effort to...
Are you asking me to defend Marvin? Because I'm not going to...
All right, I'll ask Martin. Yeah, I mean, why is he not kicking off against central government?
Well, I mean,
why is he not doing what Charlie suggested there? And I imagine Charlie would do this if he was in Marvin's shoes.
In actual fact...
Getting together with other Labour mayors from around the country and saying, no, this is not good enough.
Well, I'm sure he is doing that, but the other thing he's doing, of course, is invited all the other parties into the administration, including the Conservative
Party.
Well,
he may be saying it.
Yes.
He's not saying it, is he?
He's not saying it in this particular article that you're looking at.
No, but there are several. I've just had a look at it.
Yes, all right. Well, I mean, I'm pretty certain that he's opposed to the government's austerity policy.
Well, why isn't he shouting about it, then?
Well, let me just point out what he is doing.
This is a criticism we were making constantly.
Marvin
said, when I'm mayor, I will make sure that, you know, I'm pointing the finger at central government every time they try and impose cuts. There's little or none of that here.
All right, well, you may want more radical rhetoric from Marvin. It wouldn't make much difference to the situation, but you could shout loudly, possibly. But I will make this point. He's invited all the other parties on the council into the administration, including the Conservative Party. He needs to lead an all-party delegation to London to say to the new Chancellor of the Exchequer, Hammond, this is no good. Can you cut us some slack? Now, if he was shouting from the rooftops, that might not be a viable strategy. So you might be playing it like in that sort of a way. I don't know. I'm not at that level, thank God, and I don't have to make these decisions. But it was always going to be the way. We've had all this huffing and puffing about electing elected mayors who are going to have all this power to change things. And in actual fact, as we all know, everything in Britain is decided at the centre. It always has been. It still is. And ultimately, you've got to change the central government policy, and that means changing the government. That's what it's all about.
My suspicion is he will try and do something along those lines. But it's also, it is the shouty thing of getting together with and providing the credible opposition. And I'm not, again, partly to criticise the Labour Party, but if you could spend a bit less time fighting each other and a bit more time fighting the Tories, a lot of us would be very happy.
Or a little bit less time hobnobbing with the Rockefellers in New York and a little bit more talking to the Mayor of Liverpool about how to stop austerity. Anyway, Charlie, also, we've had the departure of Nicola Yates, the Chief Executive, as well through this whole period with Marvin.
Yeah.
I wonder if you think that may have also affected his ability to actually get a handle on what's happening with the City Council and the council officers particularly.
It's not going to help, is it? It's having a vacuum in the leading person in the council, and for whatever reason it would have been done.
Has someone been appointed in her place yet?
There's an interim person from Birmingham whose name is Stephen, I can't remember his surname. He's there for a 6-month period to deal with this crisis. So it's up to the budget and thereabouts, and then they're talking of getting a permanent succession.
Well, I think, you know, you need to hit somebody in permanently, Marvin. Come on, you know, it's having someone in there who's in a temporary.
But it's not just the chief executive, actually. If you look at the council structure, we've had the business change department, where the person in charge of that left in the run up to the election. The person who was the chief finance officer left for personal reasons before last Christmas. And then if you look at the structure of the senior manager, the posts of the managers, they were all interim bar one. So you look at it and you think, I can see how
this should be. Marvin's first task. It's like, if you have a revolution, Che Guevara would tell you this: you need to make sure you've got all your key people in place straight away. You can't fiddle about.
Yes.
Yeah, but it isn't a revolution, Tony. It's a mayoral election in Britain, where in Bristol, where the mayor has got no power because it's all in the power of central government.
Business as usual,
as we've just been saying.
Business as usual under Marvin.
Well, it is business as usual unless we're going to break out the weaponry. And I think people, in the 1980s, Liverpool City Council refused to set a rate. But we're not there. It doesn't matter. That's not going to achieve anything.
Anyway, there's an emergency protest. Charlie, there's an emergency protest about these 1,000 job cuts called by Bristol branch of Union Unite, which is being called Tomorrow, following the announcement this week of hundreds of full-time jobs will go by the end of September. I mean, this is fast, isn't it? Mr. Rees said he has to make savings to the tune of £72 million. Unite said the areas most likely to be hit in a big way would be social care for vulnerable adults, older people and children and families. Join us on the streets on Saturday to make it clear Bristol simply will not take these cuts from the Tory government anymore. Apparently, that's taking place at lunchtime in the city centre. Protests will begin at the fountains in the city centre at noon.
Yeah, sorry, it's to respond to the last part. If one council doesn't set a council tax, it'll make no difference. If it's just Liverpool and Lambeth back in the 80s, they just get pushed aside. But if 100 councils did it, that would represent a serious challenge to the government orthodoxy, and that would be the only way, I thought this for some years, the only way you could do the credible opposition to the cuts in austerity is for those 100, and then basically Labour councils, standing up and saying no. And that's the disappointing thing.
Well, one positive bit of news locally is that the police detained 260 people, although this doesn't sound like it's a positive headline, it's actually a positive story. Police detained 260 people under the Mental Health Act. Most should not have been there, as Michael Young in the Bristol Post this week. New crisis house will be set up in the Bristol region to stop police from putting people with mental health problems in cells. Between December 2014 and December 2015, Avon and Somerset, police detained 260 people in police cells under the 1983 Mental Health Act. Yet, three quarters did not present an unmanageable risk in a health setting. And it goes into the government statistics. But the government today announced it's awarded Avon and Wiltshire Mental Health Partnership Trust £820,000 to help those in such situations. So hopefully they won't in future, Charlie, have to be dealt with by the police. There is actually a dedicated service there to do it. My only worry is, I wonder if this is the same organisation which has been set up by Richard Branson to do the job. I couldn't find out in that whether that will be a kind of privatised organisation.
I don't know the details, but obviously,
anyway, I mean, at least it means that less, you know, not putting mental health onto the police to have to deal with so much.
Yeah, I mean, we have to welcome getting the extra funding and looking at the right ways of doing it, but you wonder why the police were doing it in the first place.
Well, I mean, of course, I mean, the mental health is a big Cinderella service, isn't it? And actually, when Jeremy Corbyn and Diane Abbott spoke on College Green, they were stressing giving mental health the same status as physical health, but it's all words when you haven't got any money to back it up, isn't it?
And of course, with cuts to council and government budgets, it just makes it harder still. The people who are the biggest victims of any cuts are the people who are less well off.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember when we had the debate with the police and crime commissioners in here, this is something that everybody was pretty much unified on. I mean, this is actually Virgin Care, I think their bid was in Bath, so this may have nothing to do with them whatsoever, and that was in Wiltshire and Bath, or Bath, North East, Somerset, together doing mental health work over there. Did Dave's chum, Lord Crony, break the law? This is the Daily Mail headline, by the way, folks. Break the law in a frantic bid to thwart UKIP. Mystery hotel bills and a profoundly troubling question. Well, this is the bubbling on there. This is actually from March this year, but I was really shocked to see that Marion Little, who spent about £100,000 of her own money, I imagine she was reimbursed out of Conservative Party funds, booking hotel rooms for a whole load of Conservatives to go and fight last year's general election, was actually given an OBE by... by Prince Charles. Nothing apparently can be provided, say the Daily Mail, in a campaign for free. Everything has to be given a notional value, as if it had been paid for on the commercial market. So if it's favours for friends, it still has to go down in the accounts. Notional and actual expenditure are added together, and the total has to be within the limit. It goes to the very heart of modern British democracy. Elections should not be bought by the richest candidate or party, Martin.
Well, I think that's patently wrong. I mean, we all know that money talks in political terms. And in the United States, of course, political parties are funded entirely by wealthy donors who demand their pound of flesh in return. That's pretty much what goes on here. The Labour Party used to be funded by the unions, but of course Blair, in that era, they got lots more money coming in from wealthy donors. Those wealthy donors like Michael Foster have now sued us because we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing, according to him, because he gave us all this money and now we're not doing what it was supposed to be doing. There's a real question about how political parties should be funded. In Germany, for example, political parties are funded by the state on the basis of their previous score.
Let's get to the rub here, because there's nearly 20 constituencies where there's evidence of overspend by the Conservatives, criminal investigations
they've broken the police,
which means that this government is not legitimate. If those are overturned and those are void, those election results, this government doesn't have a majority.
It doesn't, but if you look at it, they've concentrated on this skullduggery was concentrated on the seats where they were worried about UKIP. So if you had a rerun of those seats, you'd probably either get another Tory or a UKIP MP, so it wouldn't necessarily change the result.
They were targeted at marginal seats.
Yeah, but margin. Yes, well, Kevin, I mean, in actual fact,
the
electoral system has become an absolute minefield. And don't forget, the funding is also incredibly questionable. And we haven't got a democratic setup, really. And as you were saying earlier, you reach a point where by participating in the setup, you're giving credibility to the setup. And you have to ask yourself sometimes whether opposition parties try and win local elections because it gives them a chance to show that they're competent and so on.
Charlie,
but if you end up in this kind of mess, well, why, you know, at some point you might say, well, we're not going to participate.
So, Charlie, aren't we all equal under the law unless we happen to be a Conservative fixing an election returns account?
Are we all equal under the law? We might be all equal under the law, but if you're wealthy, you probably find ways around the law more easily. It's not just, I mean, actually, it's two, but one is, well, we've got a Prime Minister now who wasn't elected as Prime Minister. She just sort of inherited the job.
Well, we had the same with Gordon Brown, didn't we?
Yes. And he should have had an election straight off, perhaps. But also, it's not just the amount of money you have which can influence the outcome of election. It's also the amount of resources and people helping you have which can influence the outcome of an election. So it's quite a subtle thing, democracy and how it works. And
so why are the police, you know, not going around feeling the collar disease people and putting them on trial and getting them banged up if they've stolen an election result? Not only should the people involved be in prison, also those who there should be some kind of rerun of that election, surely. I mean, that's just your basic justice.
On the basis that's all true, then I would entirely agree with you.
I think that's right, but I think the police obviously realise they're treading in a political minefield here, and they're probably taking it, but, you know, they're hoping somebody will take this hot potato off them. Possibly they are. Don't forget, their funding depends upon keeping in with the government of the day, etc. I mean, it's all, the whole system becomes
corrupt on people
and
like
self-referential.
Theresa May. I mean, they must have already had quite an experience of losing something like a quarter of police officers with Theresa May.
Well, indeed. So they don't want to be seen to be doing something against taking a political stance.
Do you think that the senior police officers, chief constables and whatever, have been getting their fingers in the pie here rather than just leaving it to ordinary police to do this investigation and see it through?
I don't know. You'd have to ask police people that, though. I don't really know. It's an issue, isn't it? But there is obviously, when somebody's sent to prison for 2 years for stealing a bottle of water during a riot, and then this kind of thing just is like, oh, well, never mind, nobody cares, it does send a certain message, doesn't it, to disenfranchised youth of this country.
Staying with politics and not policing, though, Jeremy Corbyn calls for the Westminster magic circle to be broken. The magic circle of Westminster needs to be broken. This is ITV News, and the views of ordinary people heard, Jeremy Corbyn said in his final leadership rally before the ballot papers are sent out end of last week, addressing an estimated 3,000 Labour supporters at Ruach City Church in Kilburn, London. The party leader said he wanted to see decision making for the millions, not the millionaires. The actual quote is, he said, it's about breaking open this magic circle of Westminster. Some of our great universities, Whitehall and the boardrooms, who try to control thinking, control ideas, and control the way policy is developed, Charlie.
What does that mean? Do you know?
Martin?
Well, these are motherhood and apple pie aspirations, aren't they? We all believe in more democracy.
That sounds a bit American.
It's the democratic rhetoric of the left
wing
of the Labour Party.
Look,
he's talking about the establishment, isn't he?
He's talking about the establishment, yeah, which is where things like revolving doors, where the same people who are working for big, powerful pharmaceutical industry, for example, then suddenly find themselves health secretary or permanent secretary and that kind of thing. And there are some rules about that, but a lot of them are just being... they wait for a year and then they get their job in the pharmaceutical industry. We've seen things like the Tony Blair phenomenon, you know, where you've got the man that took us to war in Iraq, and then suddenly he's getting paid off by JP Morgan every year, millions of dollars, and he's doing tours of the world with all the big companies that have benefited from the war, made money out of the war, seeing him as their blue-eyed boy.
So the wealthy have privileged entry to the establishment. Well, that's obviously correct, but that's I don't see anything in what he said which suggests he's got a solution. I do remember from the last, not the just the mayoral election just gone, but the one before, there was a guy who was a candidate then who was saying things about how we should be much more involved in doing direct democracy, and with social media and the rise of social media, maybe there's a way of doing it and getting large numbers of people involved in putting forward decision or helping making decisions and helping formulate policies. And I wonder if there's something along that lines which could help.
Martin, one of the big problems we always have on this programme is trying to get our heads around the economy. And, I mean, you help us with that time after time. But I interviewed earlier this week a chap called Gordon Stiles. He worked running an engineering firm up in the northeast of Britain until he found it just impossible to... the bureaucracy and the market situation here in Britain, impossible to make money. And he moved his business over to China. But I spoke to him from there earlier in the week, and he puts a lot of the problems down... and here he really spells it out to do with the difference, the way that the Western banking system works, contrasting it with that of India and China.
The Maastricht Treaty forbids our country from borrowing from its own state-owned central bank. If we can do that again, then we can start investing heavily in our industry, manufacturing, science, construction, our infrastructure. But whilst we remain in the Maastricht Treaty, we can't. We're bound to buy our money from private banks. This is one of the fundamental problems that affects all countries that do not have a state banking system. Now, as it happens, nearly one third of the entire world lives in countries that have state banking, and they don't suffer from the malaise that we suffer from. And the two biggest examples would be China and India. In China, it is almost completely owned or controlled by the state, banking that is, and in India it is mostly owned or controlled by the state, approximately 90%. In those countries, because they're state-owned banking, they did not have the financial collapses that we had in the West, because it was a private banking financial crisis. It's very important to put the word private in front of it. In state bank-controlled countries, they did not have these crashes. I was there in China in 2008. Yeah, there was a little bit of concern at the end of it. The government announced this investment program of about $580 billion, but they'd already slated that money for development anyway. It was just a publicity stunt. And by April 2009, everybody was back doing business again. I think they dipped from about 10% GDP growth down to about 6% in 2008-09 period, but then it bounced back again after that.
Yes, that was Gordon Stiles there talking to me earlier this week on our dialect show. That will be dialect is on every Tuesday at noon. That will be on in a couple of weeks' time. But Martin is making quite an important point there. We don't often think about this. Is in Germany, for example, they had the Bundesbank, which was a state bank, and then Deutsche Bank, which is completely dominating the scene now. Here in Britain, it was the Bank of England. But then we've got these massive banks like HSBC, Royal Bank of Scotland, etc., who are really dominating the scene. So you've got this kind of rivalry between these state banks and private banks, and the private banks are winning.
Well, what he was doing in that clip was contrasting the fundamentally state-based system that you've got in China and in India, as he pointed out, compared with what we've got. I mean, basically, most of the money supply in a country like Britain is created by the private banking sector. And there's an organisation called Positive Money, which I'm sure you're aware of, Tony, which has been campaigning, for us to change the way in which we create money. And I think Gordon Stiles, obviously, is on that wavelength. I think he slightly misapprehends what's happened, because, of course, if the Western world collapses under the weight of private banking iniquity, which it may well do, then China and India, who are our major suppliers of goods, are not going to do very well. There's no way in which you can isolate any part of the international system from any other part of the international system.
Surely it's a lot easier to deal with when it's a state-controlled bank. You can
Absolutely.
Do something like what Roosevelt did in the 1930s, which is you can just start spending. It's a state bank. If it's a private bank that's bankrupt, it can't do anything.
Yeah, but the danger with the state organising, saying to banks, just spend, is that they might just spend it on a load of white elephants that the state wants. You've got to put some checks and balances in there. But, I mean, it's perfectly feasible to imagine. Ellen Brown pushes hard for this public banking option in the United States. The state of North Dakota has got the Bank of North Dakota, which was set up by the state of North Dakota in the 1900s, and that actually underpins the solvency of North Dakota, the only solvent state in the Union.
I always thought that the left always wanted state ownership of the banking system. I thought it was one of the sort of big things of
it is. The Bank of England was nationalised.
Well, the Bank of England was nationalised in 1946, but the problem is the Bank of England is nationalised. It's not like the Federal Reserve, which is actually, you know, ultimately controlled by the private banks. But nevertheless, you get what you call regulatory capture. The guys who work at the Bank of England are going on to work in the private sector. People from the private sector come to work, you know. Mark Carney used to work for Goldman Sachs, and then he comes to run the... In other words, they then start to get the private banker's mentality.
Let's just focus down on Mark Carnage for a minute. I mean, Mark Carney. This guy is from the Regulation Committee, in fact, one of the central committees at the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland. I mean, we were told he's from Canada. He's not really. He's a Canadian. But he was running this massive committee in Switzerland of this bank that financed the Nazis and is the central banker's central bank. So here is the guy who was responsible for the bad regulation in the noughties that led to the 2008 crisis, sitting in the middle of the Bank of England. And no wonder, you know, things aren't necessarily going too well. Anyway, what do you make of all this? Does it boil down at all to making some sense about these 1,000 job cuts we've got, Charlie? I mean, it seems sometimes, doesn't it, like that the Bank of England, Westminster, the money system, the pound, is a million miles away from us here in Bristol. And yet, we've got 1,000 people who are being... given their cards.
Absolutely. I do remember, it was Caroline Lucas was talking about the Green Deal, or the Green New Deal, which is the Green Party and Green Movement thing about pushing the whole environmental energy efficiency agenda, and saying how the government was opposed to it because of the cost of it. And then when the banks went bust, they suddenly found $100 billion to prop up HBOS and the Royal Bank of Scotland. And it does make you wonder if the money... Why they can't find the money for the right things rather than find the money for the wrong things. I suppose the other thing I'd say is I actually worked for HBOS in... I actually worked for a place called Clerical Medical about 15 years ago, and they used to show us these TV programmes every week with James Crosby. as was then, who's in charge of it. It was really gung-ho for all the things that they did about expand, 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 take over, take over, take over. And you just sort of looked at it and you assumed he knew what he was doing. And it's only now that you realised, well, the last however many years,
well, I'll tell you what,
he had no idea.
Rule number one, never assume anything. Rule
Lesson
number
learned.
One. Rule number one. Also, it was interesting, I think, because Louis Sherwood was chairman of Clerical Medical, I remember, who I got to know on the, or he was one of the, certainly one of the top people at Clerical Medical, and almost within a few months of him dying, the whole place was flattened. It's just now a kind of rubble pit, isn't it, as you go along Temple Way on the
I used to work in that very ugly building.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just, I mean, what is going on when we've got buildings like that in the city centre that's just a, you know, basically a place for rats to run around, which it
well there's a whole
be.
Separate thing which is it actually ties in with the whole the housing crisis and in Bristol is why god they've been talking about the however many thousand stalled sites within Bristol, why they're not being built on, and partly it's sort of developers sitting on it waiting for the right opportunity.
Well, the main reason is because people can't afford the prices of the existing houses these developers have built, so they go and build a whole bunch of houses like they have in the city centre, and they can't sell them all, so they're not going to build any more until they finish selling the ones they've already built.
Well, I think there's an interest, but I do have a bit of sympathy for developers because I having met one and chatted to him about their development, you actually realise the risk they take up front. And how much of that's them selling me a line, and going back to your rule one, how much that's them selling you a line, how much is true. But there's also an interest in them of keeping the prices high to keep their profits up and therefore slowing down the...
Okay, let's move on to another story now. UK terror law watchdog, this is tail end of last week, we just missed this on Friday, has given a green light to powers for spy agencies to collect bulk data. Oops, missed this one. There's another wonderful little thing Theresa May's got for us from her time at the Home Office, now taking over control at the bridge of the good ship Britain. Plans to replace the Human Rights Act with the British Bill of Rights will go ahead, Justice Secretary confirms. Now, hang on a minute, because I seem to remember when Theresa May was running to be Prime Minister, take over for, as leader of the Conservative Party, both of these we were talked about as we're going to get rid of that, so we're not going to be doing all this mass spying, and we're not going to be getting rid of the Human Rights Act, and now we hear, oh, it is going to happen again. So it seems like almost this is being made up on the back of an envelope, but it's all pretty scary stuff. I would suggest, anyway, the idea that MPs, journalists, lawyers, etc. can be spied on by GCHQ and by the American Security Services is tantamount to the beginnings of a police state. Anyway, Martin, what do you make of this one?
Well, I think whether Theresa May is the Prime Minister or not, these things are in the pipeline anyway, because they're coming from outside the official political system. You know, we're talking here about the deep state.
Well, Theresa May said, "Oh, this Snoopers Charter thing. Oh, I don't think it's a good idea. You know, we're going to have to get rid of this." Now, all of a sudden, everyone's forgotten that, and it's popping up again. And it's going to happen.
I think that's been ongoing, and there is a real question mark of if there's any legal basis for the spying that they've been doing. But the other thing about the Human Rights Act is more politically challenging, because of course there's no the Human Rights Act is the European Human Rights and you know, all the rest of it. It's nothing to do with the European Union, so it's part of the internal feud in the Tory party to get rid of it. And if it's going to be replaced by a British Bill of Rights, I don't know, they're going to need to pay a lot of people. They have to have teams and teams of people negotiating Brexit, and while we're doing that, we're going to have another even more teams of people negotiating how to get out of the Human Rights Act and replace it with something else.
Well, if they're going to have a British Bill of Rights, what bits is it going to leave out?
Yes, what bits of the international human rights aren't we going to get?
Which one don't you need? And you probably need them all, in which case, why not just adopt the whole thing?
Well, in any case, they're universal, aren't they? That's the whole principle. There aren't just British rights, there are human rights.
Well, yes.
Well, there is supposed to be something called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which we're signed up to, but apparently that's all optional. So, anyway, so we'll have to see what happens with that. But apparently there is no majority in the House of Commons to pass such an act. So Liz Truss, whose dismissed reports the government is abandoning the policy, may not know what she's talking about. Who knows? Anyway, private landlords, double housing benefit haul to £9.3 billion. Yes, folks, £9.3 billion of housing benefit for private landlords. Nearly all half of all housing benefit claimants are now in work. Now, Charlie, look, this is getting crazy, isn't it? Housing benefit is basically you need it, otherwise you're going to get evicted. And we're seeing now that half of the people who are claiming housing benefit have actually got jobs.
Yeah,
so this is really what the signal, I suppose, that's going out from this is that work is no longer a route out of poverty. You're going to be on benefits whether you're working or not, certainly if you're at the lower end of the spectrum.
Well, I think the signal I'll take out of it is that we need to build more housing and especially give people in the private rented sector alternatives which they don't have now. I suppose to us, the government has made it as difficult as possible for councils or anybody to build social housing, pretty much. So the private rented sector is becoming increasingly significant, and you have people on benefits having to pay private landlords to do it. What we need to do is, well, one obvious thing is to start building lots of council housing, and there are things the government would need to do to allow us to do that.
City Council doing that?
Right, the problem you got is that it's the right to buy. So every house they build, all the best stock, people would, not surprisingly, want to own. So there's been a net decrease in houses over the past 20, however many years. A very small number of council housings were built recently. The council has been talking about setting up a housing company, and Paul Smith, who I'm sure you either have had or will get on, is pursuing it quite... Well, I'm quite impressed with it, actually, but... It's in pursuing the housing agenda, but the housing company, a sort of arm's length housing company, is the route at the moment, which looks like the council could be building its own housing stock.
Well, I think that Paul Smith and others are doing their best in the circumstances, because it's all the rules are all rigged against doing anything sensible,
yes,
as we know. I mean, one of the most pernicious things was that Ian Duncan Smith's Universal Credit, because of its reform of individual behaviour, he was suggesting that once Universal Credit comes in, when it comes in, all the housing benefit will be paid directly to the tenant, and then they will pass it on to the landlord so that they've got to actually manage their own money. Now, on that basis, private landlords in Eastern, I know this because I've tried to get sort of, will not rent to people on benefits. And in fact, big buy-to-let owners who are actually Tory donors in the South East, the biggest buy-to-letters in the country, forgotten the name, as soon as this rule came through, said, right, well, we've got hundreds or thousands of people on benefits in our houses at the minute. Not only are we not going to take any more, we're going to kick those people out, and we want to put in East Europeans who are in work who will pay the rent. In other words, a load of people are actually being written out of the housing market altogether at the moment, completely.
We'll be talking about a little bit more about that in a minute, but Martin, has this got anything to do with the fact that almost all private landlords will be Tory voters? Federation Chief Executive David Orr said it's madness to spend £9 billion of taxpayers' money lining the pockets of private landlords rather than using it to build affordable homes. £9 billion.
Absolutely right. And of course, if you actually look at the interests of MPs, a substantial majority of MPs are in fact private landlords. There you go.
Looking at this whole problem with people that don't have anywhere to live, we've got a little thing in the Bristol Post by Linda Church. I think it's Linda Churchill. In the Bristol Post, will the travellers be gone from the Downs in time for the massive attack gig? Well, I drove past the Downs the other day. Don't know if you've cycled past there recently, Charlie, but it's actually quite nice. Looks like some kind of little festival going on. A whole load of travellers camped up on the Downs, almost like the old days, like the 1980s.
I haven't seen it myself. I thought, was this something about the traveller queen who's dying? I thought I'd heard she'd moving to Dublin or something?
About 10 caravans moved in near to the White Tree roundabout.
Traveller
August the 17th.
Violet Crumlish.
And since then, more have joined them. They've been granted a court order on Tuesday, apparently, this week, which is giving the council legal enforcement powers to remove them all. He added he expected the site to be cleared by the end of the week. Comes as 27,000 people will be heading to Massive Attack's homecoming gig on Saturday, September the 3rd. But, I mean, this attempt to link it to Massive Attack is a kind of spurious, really, Martin. I mean, we've got travellers. We've had them in this country, good God, probably 8,000 years, 10,000 years of travellers, but no longer are travellers allowed. Even if they've decided that they want to spend a few weeks up on the Downs, the council is saying no Massive Attack gigs have got to happen, they can't be moved to a different part of the Downs, etc.
I remember this being a big issue in Bristol when I first moved in the 1990s with travellers. There's all sorts of debate about all the trouble they caused and all the rest of it. And then they set up a camp, two camps, one in Ashton Vale and I can't remember where the other one was. And I think the number of incidents dropped by 99%, and it stopped being a trouble. And surely the thing to do is actually give them somewhere to go. Surely we should just tolerate people.
Yeah, and also they should be able to stop by the side of the road if they want to on some of these massive wide verges. Why on earth not? They get moved on by the police. Martin, have we actually come anywhere with our policy towards dealing with this particular part of society, trapped people that wish to live a travelling lifestyle?
Well, the way this has happened is that they've been on the Downs, they've been to see Violet Crumlish, the council has pursued it through the civil courts, look, we need this room, you've got to move on, and then they'll have to move on. I think those who want to live in a permanent site, there should be enough permanent sites. We should be tolerant, as we said, but, you know, moving on is part of being a traveller, isn't it?
Yes, but this is the idea is that travellers decide they want to stay in a place for a few weeks maybe and then move on anyway. Why do we have to have them evicted?
It depends if they are right in the middle of where the massive attack gig's going to be or not, isn't it?
They could move across to another part of the Downs.
Well, maybe that's what should happen then, Tony.
You should go and help the council in court to evict them.
Look, I'm just a commentator on the radio.
I'm sure you are,
commentator and chief evictor.
Yes. Anyway, the Severn Bridge toll, if it increased with inflation, it would be less than £1, so why are we paying £6? It's just coming up to the 50th anniversary of the first Severn crossing, that lovely old suspension bridge. I always try and travel over there rather than the new one. I don't like the new one. If I get half a chance, the company that owns it made nearly £40 million last year. That's enough profit to build five Severn Bridges every year if you use 1966 money. These people are just fleecing us, Charlie, aren't they? Is this ever going to be free, even though we've paid for it something like 100 times over, the Severn Bridges?
Is it ever going to be free? I have absolutely no idea. I guess it'll depend on the government buying it.
Well, I'll tell you when it is free, if you cycle over it.
Right, well, I'll do that. Perhaps we should turn it into a cycle route.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is, isn't it, the old Severn crossing? The new one, there's no provision, I don't think, for any kind of people to walk across or cycle, as far as I know. I haven't seen any. It cost £8 million to build, and it cost 3.5 years. Blimey. Those were the days, Martin.
Well, yes, but, I mean, we are constantly fleeced by utility companies, by the people who build bridges, by private landlords, by the City of London, which then demands funding when it crashes things, and everybody complains and moans that there's too many travellers, too many disabled people. That's where the money's gone.
By the way, awful bit of news is that nobody wants to do the Metro bus as well this week, Charlie. What a joke this is, honestly. What an absolute rubbish project to start with, and there's no one to operate it. Anyway,
yes.
I thought we'd have a listen to, as it's a bank holiday, a lovely chap, and his name's Aubrey Punter. He drove the last holiday special train back in September 1966, 50 years ago, through Midsummer Norton, which is on the Somerset and Dorset line. Anyone that's sitting out there in traffic on these motorways out there should remember that actually most people from the north came down to the south and the southwest on those trains, and he was very privileged to be the fireman on the very last one. So let's have a listen to him now.
The last train was of 12 coaches, 426 ton, the largest load ever to be worked by one single engine.
Were they full, the coaches?
They were all full, going back up off of holiday. And I was working flat out to keep the steam level over on the engine. And as we were going along, I was pulling coal forward with a shovel and a pick to put, and as soon as I stepped out of the tender to put it on the fire, it was going faster as you could put it in there. Like, it had to be worked heavy because this line, it was not very much of it on the flat, it was all uphill, round curves. The highest point here was a place called Masbury, 800 feet above sea level. That was the most heaviest journey that ever going there. We were only doing a job at the time, and it was only from a man called Ivo Peters, who used to photograph everything and put it in a railway magazine by Ian Allen, that it started to become famous. And the line side was full of people seeing, waving goodbye to the fact that it was running.
Beats a traffic jam on the M5, doesn't it? Anyway, that's all we've got time for now. We'll be back. That was Charlie Bolton, Green leader on the City Council and Southfield councillor. We'll be back after the news.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.